Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's October 30th. Currently, I've got 23 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 29 degrees in the Heber Valley with a bit of sunshine poking out. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Good morning. Boy, what a cold start along the Wasatch Back on this Wednesday. Highs today still staying cold as well, 36 degrees for Park City. We have a little bit of moisture lingering, so we're seeing some sunshine. Still have a slight chance of a stray snow shower, I should say, but not looking at any accumulation. Overnight lows are cold once again, 20 degrees for an overnight low in Park City, 42 for the high tomorrow. So a gradual warm up into Halloween and the end of the week, mid-40s on Friday. Should be dry tomorrow. We'll see some high clouds pass by, but all in all, south flow is increasing ahead of another storm system moving in this weekend. We'll stay in the mid-40s on Saturday. We'll see clouds increase with a slight chance of a rain shower late in the day. Snow showers expected on Sunday at this point. Overnight lows in the upper 20s with a high near 40 on Sunday. And then we're in the upper 30s with partly cloudy skies. A trough of low pressure is going to be working its way through the desert southwest, but still impacting portions of the Beehive State with just a little bit of moisture rotating around it. So we'll keep about a 20 to 30% chance of a isolated snow shower in the mix early next week. Heber looking at 41 today with partly cloudy skies, maybe a stray shower as well. Partly cloudy on Halloween. Overnight lows though in the teens into tomorrow with a high of 47 on Halloween. Temperatures of course going to cool off quickly as the sun goes down. So have to wear coats likely tomorrow. Bundle up. Temperatures on Friday to 51. We're going to hang out the low 50s on Saturday. Overnight lows will continue to be in the 20s into the weekend, with showers increasing late Saturday for Heber. Rain and snow showers expected on Sunday with highs near 47. We'll be in the mid-40s early next week for Heber with overnight lows in the low 20s as well. And we'll keep that chance of some isolated shower potential, rain and snow showers Monday, Tuesday.
Okay, Nate. Hey, thanks.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'm scheduled to talk with former Facebook employee and whistleblower Frances Haugen. She'll be discussing social media impact on teens' mental health at the Grand Theater, Salt Lake Community College next week. Also be talking with David Tellian. He is the owner of Alpine Forestry. He'll be telling us a little bit more about the slash burning piles happening this week. The executive director of Ziegfeld Theater, Caleb Perry, talking about the opening of Sweeney Todd at the Egyptian Theater tonight. And finally, Bright Futures founder Tommy Tanzer and Jen Bello with Park City Education Foundation talk about the 10th anniversary celebration and the program's success. Then stay tuned for the mountain life. Today's guests include local mountain biker and Olympic silver medalist from the Paris Olympics, Hallie Batten. She talks about winning her medal growing up in Park City and why she continues to love the sport. Then naturopathic physician Dr. Nicole Kane, a pioneer in integrative approaches for mental and emotional wellness, explores a holistic approach to ridding ourselves of anxiety. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life. Of course, you can hear that right after the local news hour at 9 o'clock. Back in 2021, Frances Haugen disclosed tens of thousands of Facebook's internal documents to the Securities and Exchange Commission, as well as the Wall Street Journal. She's the featured guest next week in an event being hosted by Salt Lake Community College at the Grand Theater on November 7th. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning to you, Frances. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Well, I was going to say, just first of all, thank you for doing what you did. I guess, do you hear that enough, or are you having some regrets at this point?
I grew up in the Midwest, so getting attention is actually like a thing I avoid. And so I would say I've gotten plenty of acknowledgement, and the compliments are lovely, but they're absolutely not necessary at this point.
All right. Well, you've written a memoir, The Power of One, How I Found the Strength to Tell the Truth and Why I Blew the Whistle on Facebook last year. So people can read that to find out why you did what you did. I guess, can you just give us the Reader Digest version of what's wrong with the social media algorithms that have been developed?
Sure. You know, the core goal I had in that book was, you know, these topics are so complicated and so easy to demonize people. You know, one of the things that I think surprises people about Facebook is it's full of really kind, conscientious people. But we're dealing with a system of incentives that's very different than basically any other powerful industry in the United States. They can cut corners and no one ever sees it. You know, these are opaque companies. You know, things happen on data centers that we don't know, but deeply influence our lives, impact our kids. And so in a world where you can cut corners and no one's going to notice anything, corners end up getting cut. And as a result, Facebook over and over again, when facing conflicts between public safety and their profits, chose profits.
Now, are these algorithms that you helped develop for Facebook?
You know, it's interesting. I did not work on the distribution algorithms. I worked on things called integrity algorithms, but I did work on distribution algorithms at places like Pinterest and Yelp. And so part of why I can be really empathetic to my coworkers is I built very similar products at other companies. It's just we lived in a culture where you didn't really think about how this could be misused. And we were allowed to do that because there was no oversight. The public had no rights to ask questions.
So what's changed, if anything, as a result of you getting this information out?
So one of the most important things that's changed is 44 U.S. states have sued Meta, saying, you guys are basically the tobacco companies again. You knew you were hurting kids. You lied to the public and said, these things are fine. You hid the data. You buried it. You intentionally went out there and confused the public. If that lawsuit ends up getting settled, and there's a good chance that it's going to get settled in the next 6 months, we're going to see massive changes in how social media works for our kids. And we're already getting little tiny tastes of that. So Meta came out in a very odd product announcement maybe a month ago and said, in the next 60 days, we're going to make all youth accounts private. We're going to turn off notifications at night. We're going to give kids more control over what content they see online. Those are features that have been asked for 10 years and never were given. But something's happening. The things are changing. And so I think we're going to see a lot of changes over the next year.
Yeah, now Utah is one of those states that is suing Meta.
Mm-hmm.
Are you facing any personal risk as a result of this? I mean, are you facing legal challenges, anything like that?
You know, before I came forward, we didn't know how any of that was going to go. You know, would I get stalkers? Would the paparazzi show up at my place? Would Facebook sue me? You know, it was a trillion-dollar company. I've been incredibly, incredibly blessed that none of the things that we were afraid of came to pass. You know, Meta has never sued a U.S. employee. I get treated very politely online, which sounds impossible, but I have open DMs, open emails. Anyone can contact me. I feel very grateful that the public has held me so constructively as I came forward.
Now, are we still seeing from your perspective that Facebook, Instagram, all of that continues to spread misinformation and other harmful content, especially during the presidential contest here?
You know, it's interesting. It seems like they've taken a very different strategy this year, which is, you know, if you're worried about big tech companies controlling what you get to know, what you get to say, you should be very, very concerned. Because they've taken a very brute force approach this year, which is they've said, if we believe what you're saying is in any way political, we're just not going to distribute it to other people. You know, we're going to, your followers can get it, but, you know, we're not going to let you be eligible for most of the normal parts of these processes. But the problem is they never told us what counted as political. And in a democracy, it's completely unreasonable that companies that run the information ecosystem get to decide, you know, just carte blanche what we do and don't get to say online.
The community conversation is happening Thursday, November 7th at Salt Lake Community College's Grand Theater. Seating is limited. I'll have details after I hang up with you. But the discussion that you're going to be talking about is social media impact on teens' mental health. So what are you going to be telling them? Turn it off? Take the phones away?
So one of the big topics I've been trying to raise awareness on for the last year is for people who don't have, you know, tweens or maybe even younger, they don't realize that social media is not just a teenager issue anymore. We might see the worst consequences by the time a kid turns 16. But, you know, even as far back as 2022, 30% of 7 to 9-year-olds were on social media. You know, the conversation we're going to have is on what should be our relationship with social media? When should kids start using it? Why is taking a little bit of a pause so important? And what can platforms do to make products that are safer for kids? Because, you know, maybe the right answer is for us to say, until platforms can act responsibly, we do need to restrict access to social media. But we don't have to live in a world where we cut off kids. We can live in a world where we demand more, and we demand more respect for our children. by holding platforms to higher standards and requiring things like transparency.
And I just wanted to note that this year, Park City School District instituted a pilot program at our junior high school for 8th and 9th graders, basically depositing their cell phones in a locked pouch that they can open at the end of the day, and they carry the pouch around like they would their backpack and computer. Have you heard about programs like this and whether or not they are making a difference?
So this is, again, one of these things where unless you're a parent, unless you're living with the firsthand costs of social media, it seems that might seem kind of draconian, you know, might seem kind of extreme. But the reality is when you look at the data on what happens when kids have phones in their laps during the school day, and I get it. You can say, well, these kids should have more self-discipline. Have you talked to a 12-year-old with a smartphone? When kids have a phone in their laps, and remember, if your friends have their phones in their laps, you're getting messages all day. You're getting pings. There's a social expectation that you have to be available. It's very, very hard to split your attention between this device that's designed to be addictive and math class. And so what we see when we look across different environments is that if you have that split attention, kids fall behind. And it's unfair to our kids to ask them to fight against hundreds of thousands of product designers who are meant to keep them glued to their phones while they're trying to learn trigonometry.
Okay. I'm going to leave it at that because I know you've got somewhere else to be. I appreciate your time this morning.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Again, that's Frances Haugen. She will be giving a keynote address next week, November 7th, at the Grand Theater at Salt Lake Community College. Following that keynote, there'll be a 45-minute panel discussion with local experts regarding social media's impacts on teens. She'll also be hosting a book signing between 8:30 and 9 p.m. Tickets are free and available through the Grand Theater. As I mentioned, seating is limited. That's Grand Theater Company, Theater TRECompany.com. Well, the prescribed fire season is underway in Park City, and on the phone to give us a little bit of an explanation of what's being done and why is the owner of Alpine Forestry, David Tellian. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Leslie. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can. So yesterday, driving through the basin, I could smell smoke, but I couldn't with all the clouds see it. So where are you burning?
So yesterday we started burning in the Sun Peak area, and that's kind of along the whole entire Bear Hollow Drive corridor. There will be burning going on both sides of Bear Hollow Drive in and around that community. And then we've got quite a number of other projects in other areas coming up too.
Okay, where do you head from there?
From there, we'll probably head over to the Pine Brook area where we have burning on their open space, about 20 acres worth, more on the upper reaches of Pine Brook, but still near some of the homes there on Canyon Drive, Buckboard Drive, Stagecoach, that area.
Okay. And you guys kind of know where to go? You know where you left these burn piles?
Yeah, correct. This is all kind of the, you know, follow up to a busy season's worth of cutting on these open spaces. So everything's mapped out, planned, and, you know, with the seasonal pattern change here that really kicked off yesterday, that opens the window for us to come in and get the burning done. And we'll be on it as long as we can, depending on how quick more winter moisture comes. Sometimes we get shut down where it's just too much snow.
Sure. So how much burning is to be done? I mean, do you have a number of piles?
It's definitely in the thousands. There was about 150 acres worth of piling done in the greater Park City area over the summer, which has, you know, we count piles per acre, depending on the area, it could be from anywhere from like 15 to about 50 piles per acre. And so there's quite a bit to be done, and that's why we've got to pounce on the conditions when they're good.
Yeah. So you're cutting down, you're burning what was cut down this season, or do you need to let it dry out a year or so?
Well, this summer in particular was pretty dry, as you remember. Some of these piles were cut as early as May, and with as dry as a summer as we had, they're ready to go right now. Some of the stuff that we have on the docket this fall is from the previous season, and then there's a good chance that we won't get to everything that we need to, again, because it's so forecast and conditions-based.
Yeah.
So that'll give it extra time to dry, you know, into next year.
And when you're burning, how do you ensure that you know, homes and property stay safe?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think, you know, in light of all of us watching the Yellow Lake fire rip off there for the first couple weeks of October, I mean, that was quite an anomalous, you know, experience for this area. But again, a tribute to how dry things were. When we get, you know, this is really the second storm system that we've had in the past few weeks. And, you know, the days are so much shorter. We get a lot more humidity at night now. All that has really changed the fuel conditions, you know, around these areas where we're burning. But then also just, you know, literally on the ground where we can safely light a pile and keep an eye on it. But we can be assured it's not going to spread.
Okay. And then how can people find out where you'll be and when?
So we'll be working with the park record and with KPCW again, trying to get the word out. We also have our Instagram going. It's at Alpine Forestry, where we have, we'll be putting daily updates of where the crew is working. But a lot of these areas, you know, have some of their own, you know, messaging mechanisms. For instance, you know, an HOA, when we let them know, hey, we're about 3 days out from getting there, they put out, you know, notices and email blasts to their members. So we're just trying to get the word out, you know, any way we can. And then, you know, we also have signage up in key areas where the smoke is really visible. And so those that didn't get a notice otherwise, you know, can at least see a sign.
Okay. Anything else you want to let our listeners know?
Yeah, I just think that this is a really, you know, we're about 5 years into this becoming more commonplace, you know, right around the Wasatch Back. And I realize it can be startling for some, and the smoke, even though it's short duration, you know, can be a nuisance. But know that the practitioners out there are really looking at the conditions closely and making those calls and trying to get the work done as safely and efficiently as possible, but also with, you know, those keeping the smoke in check and, yeah, trying to make people aware of really how important the work is. And there's just limited time to do it, too.
Okay. David, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. Have a great day.
That's the owner of Alpine Forestry, David Tellian. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, a developer wants to create a new community of homes, shopping, and amenities on 4,000 acres northeast of Heber City. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more about that.
The project, known as Wasatch Highlands, would transform the land between Red Ledges and Wolf Creek Ranch. It includes about 720 acres of state-owned land, plus 3,500 acres owned by the Christensen family. Philo Development is partnering with the landowners on the proposed project. The developers want to annex into Heber City, but to do so, Heber first needs to amend the boundaries of its expansion map. That process is getting underway, but county leaders are urging the city to proceed carefully. The land is currently part of the preservation zone, with only one home permitted for every 160 acres. If the properties become part of Heber City, Wasatch Highlands could add thousands of homes to the area, plus shopping and other amenities. The process of amending the annexation map began at a Heber City Planning Commission meeting earlier this month, where developers shared their vision for the land, which they described as an architect and engineer's dream.
There's really not much left to develop, and frankly, we represent a large portion of that.
That's Philo Development partner Greg Whitehead. He says his team is eager to preserve the natural beauty of the landscape.
If I'm out walking with my children and we see a moose or we see an elk or a deer or something, I mean, that's an amenity in and of itself, and we want to capture that. So we're doing our best to make this project financially feasible, but also sustainable with the environment and the surroundings, and really make it a win-win with the community.
He says about half of the acreage will be public open space, including walking and mountain biking trails. There will be a mix of detached single-family homes, townhomes, and commercial spaces in the developed areas. Whitehead says he also envisions fire and police stations and municipal buildings in the development. He says the non-residential spaces will help mitigate the traffic impact of the growth.
The main reason why we want to have commercial up in this area is we want to keep people up here. If we can lower the amount of trips that has to go down and into the city center of Hebert, that, I mean, that just is a lot of traffic that gets reduced off the roads.
Whitehead also says a private water owner has agreed to provide enough water for the project. But Wasatch County leaders are skeptical that the development is wise. County Planning Director Doug Smith told the Hebert Planning Commission the roads aren't ready to accommodate the traffic that would come with the homes. He also voiced concerns about sewer and water utilities reaching the proposed development.
We hope that you make some very deliberate decisions on this and look at the issues, worried that a project like this, if not done properly, and then the capacity for the roads not thought of properly, you would ruin the quality of life for all those people that travel down Lake Creek.
Just changing the annexation map can take 3 or 4 months. There will be more Planning Commission meetings, plus a public hearing before the Heber City Council makes its decision. And amending the annexation map does not guarantee that the properties will be annexed. The property owners would still need to go through the annexation process and negotiate a development agreement with the city. Meanwhile, Wasatch County leaders are trying to head off the development. At a special session Wednesday, they'll discuss a letter to Heber City leaders urging them to slow down and reconsider the annexation application. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Opening tonight at the historic Egyptian Theater on Main Street is the Ziegfeld Theater's production of Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. On the phone to tell us more, I have the executive director of the Ziegfeld Theater, Caleb Perry. Good morning, Caleb.
Hi, how's it going?
Doing great, thanks. So what's your role in this production?
So I was fortunate enough to be the director on this one. And so, I've been spending my time directing, working with the cast, and getting it all ready to have you guys see it up there in Park City.
Okay, well, tell us about Sweeney Todd. It's described as one of the darkest musicals ever written.
Sweeney Todd is a tale, if you don't know about it, you know, it's about a barber that's on a revenge spree. And so it has all the really fun Halloween elements. You know, you get lots, plenty of murder. There's blood on stage. There's a murder chair with a slide. We send bodies down the slide. Like, it's really, really fun. You get all of that really fun stuff. But then the show itself is actually quite dark. Like they say, I mean, it is one of the most dark musicals written, and it really is a tragedy by definition, not to spoil anything, but it's a dark look at what happens to us as humanity if we go down these rabbit holes of revenge. You know, this guy had his wife and daughter taken away from him, and then he was sent to prison, and he's back to London to make things right in his godless eyes against this pious religious guy, this judge who's yielding his power for evil. And so it's really interesting. You get the villain here, Sweeney Todd, is quite justified, and he's our hero also as our villain, the real villain being the judge using power for or piety for power. And so it's really quite a dark show. Yes, very dark.
Yeah, so, I mean, a dark and dreadful story set to music just seems kind of weird. I mean, am I the only one who thinks of musicals being kind of uplifting?
I mean, it definitely has moments. I think musicals are so important because music is so powerful, and that's the thing we have to talk about here is the music. I mean, it's pretty much an opera. The whole thing is sung, and the orchestration is absolutely gorgeous. And, we aren't able to pack in a whole orchestra into the Egyptian Theater, of course, but somebody did and got to record it. And so the orchestration is absolutely gorgeous to listen to. And our cast, their vocals are out of this world good. I mean, from Todd and Lovett all the way down to our ensemble, everybody, you won't hear this music sung live any better than this. You just won't. And so that's the thing about it, is it is so dark, but it is gorgeous. I mean, every character has their own theme that you'll hear throughout. I mean, it is a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of theater. And I know that sounds so weird, but you know, our set is very, you'll be transported. You do not want to miss this one.
What are some of the more familiar songs that people might recognize?
Nothing's Gonna Harm You is a very popular one. They could sung in the second act by an amazing local teenager here. Nothing's Gonna Harm You is one. Of course, the title song, Demon Barber of Fleet Street. Worst Pies in London is a very popular musical theater song. And A Little Priest is a really fun song all about how different people of different occupations might taste when cooked into a meat pie. And so that's a really, really fun song talking about all of that. Yeah. So yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any other big ones, but yeah. Well,
how many do you have in the cast?
It's a cast of 20. They're just absolutely incredible. The ensemble work in the show is really notable. They have really helped create this dark, dirty, dingy, crowded London from 1846. And so it's awesome. They're great. And their music is some of the most challenging music in all of musical theater. I mean, there's one point, a quintet, where you've got five harmonies that are trying not to fit where they're fitting. And it's gorgeous and haunting and amazing. And boy, do they nail it. So
now you mentioned one local teen. What did he came to the auditions and made it?
Yes. So we here at the Ziegfeld Theater up in Ogden, we have quite a robust theater program for kids. You know, we start them at 5 here, 5 through 18. And one of the most amazing things about that is we're training this youth to be incredible. And so Fletcher Schweppe is a youth from our program. He got to play, you know, Lancelot in the teen production of Spamalot a few years back. He's just a great kid. He's got a lot of stage experience, and he came out for this, and boy, is he amazing as that. He's playing Toby, who's a teenager, you know, there helping Mrs. Lovett, and not unbeknownst to him is serving up, you know, dead bodies to the population. And so it's quite good.
Yeah. Any other Summit or Wasatch County actors that you're aware of?
Yeah. We've got quite a few folks in this. We've got a lot of our ensemble comes out of Salt Lake. And we've got Cameron Kapatnov is playing our Sweeney. And Cameron has done a lot of stuff for us here over the years. He's just absolutely incredible. So,
all right. Now, The play or musical originally opened in 1979 on Broadway. What gives this production such lasting power?
I think it's just, honestly, the story is just, it's so powerful. It's almost like Romeo and Juliet. I mean, there's something about I think all of us can relate to revenge, and this story is told so beautifully in juxtaposition to all the horror that's going on. You have this gorgeous music happening, and you know, Stephen Sondheim has written so much and is so known for those wonderful melodies. And really it's gorgeous. It affects you in a way that you didn't know it was going to affect you, especially if you're coming into it thinking like, it's Halloween, let's go get some horror. And that's there for you, and it's great. But, you know, I think about it all the time when people talk about different things. When you come to a space, it's not about, you know, the thing you got or what you got for the price or, you know, that trinket or whatever, but it's all about how you feel. And theater is all about how we can make people feel. And this show will affect you. You'll come and you'll feel something and you'll get everything else out of it, but you'll also be affected by, you know, what does it look like to be bloodthirsty, revengeful, and how am I doing that in my life? You know, I might not be on a murderous rampage, but maybe there's something with my neighbor I haven't let go. And that that really can sync with us. And that, I think, is the changing power of theater. And what makes a story like this last so long is because no matter who you are, you watch a show like this and you can relate and you'll be affected. Like, you're going to go on Todd's journey and see what happens to him. You know, it's so odd to have a hero, have a villain as your hero also. It's fascinating.
Okay, well, it is not for everyone. I'm going to put that disclaimer out because I believe that the recommendation is audiences 16 and over, just due to the violence, gore, and adult themes. There are six shows starting tonight, 8 p.m., running Thursday, Friday night at 8, as well as Saturday at 8. There's also a 3 o'clock matinee on Saturday the 2nd, and the final show Sunday, November 3rd at 5 p.m. Anything else you wanted to mention, Caleb?
I would just give it a big push for tomorrow night. I mean, if you don't have anything going for Halloween, this is your perfect Halloween date night, like right there on Main Street. So come see the show.
Okay. Caleb Perry, again, the executive director, also the director of the production of Sweeney Todd, opening tonight at the Historic Egyptian Theater on Main Street. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Last Saturday, the Park City Education Foundation and board member Tommy Tanzer celebrated the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Bright Futures Program. Tommy, along with Jen Bellow from the Ed Foundation, join me now in the studio. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Tommy, why was this important to celebrate to you?
Well, first of all, look how fast 10 years went. For me, this program, I started when before there was Bright Futures. I started a thing called Back to Our Roots in honor of Eileen Bailey. And she was a third grade teacher along with me back in in the 70s and 80s. And she passed away in 06, and I approached a bunch of the former students, some of which were there that night. So they were in their late 30s at the time. And this group started Back to Our Roots, the Eileen Bailey Foundation. We did really well. We tried to do on a mini scale what some of the Ed Foundation and others do with these events, raising money. You were at some of them. And yet, you can raise all the money and throw all the money you want at something, but it doesn't really mean it would succeed. And Abby wanted a certain amount of money for us to start this program. We met the man that you met, he and his wife the other night, Eric Guerin and Nancy Guerin, and he had started a program called Bright Prospects in California, and this was exactly what it was. Not just this funding, but it was a mentoring, teaching what Anna Williams teaches in the school, what Melanie Moffitt teaches in the school with helping take the tests, get SATs, get ready for college. But then what we found is you needed this group to carry them to the next step. And that's where Abby came in and Jennifer came in, and the Ed Foundation began, along with help from the Community Foundation, and funded the beginning of this program. And in 10 years, look what it's become.
Yeah, so you basically merged the Back to Our Roots into Bright Futures.
It's sort of, right, that's what happened. And yet, it was with the Ed Foundation helping us to start it, and Eric's program, he gave us the whole program. The software, the hardware, the training, all that stuff. And there's a real good possibility that this kind of a program can be replicated in the Heber, in the Camas, in the Colville, in the Ogden, in Salt Lake. So it's very bright future for this program.
All right, so Jen, the Bright Futures now managed through the Ed Foundation?
Yes, exactly. So what Tommy had done, he didn't give himself all the credit to. He had created kind of a mentoring program once the students were in college. But it was sort of ad hoc, you know, and it needed, I think, more structure around it. And so that's where the Ed Foundation came in. So this is the only program that we do run ourselves in conjunction with the school district. So for instance, the high school does an incredible job getting the students academically ready and graduating students. I mean, the graduation rate is like 98% for all students, and it's the highest in the state for first gen. And so what we're working on now is budgeting and working on the FAFSA and making sure, you know, what does all your money look like? What kind of majors are you thinking about, and bringing in panels for students to learn about what kind of jobs there are out there. And then we have a program managers who work with the kids once they're in college. Because so the high school was getting the kids to college, but then the dropout rate was pretty high because that structure of high school is gone. And that's really where Bright Futures shines, is ensuring kids can stay in college till they graduate. So nationwide, the graduation rate for first-gen students is 11%. And Bright Futures at this point is about at 83%. And getting better. So the first three graduating classes really had to deal with COVID. So getting the program going and then COVID hitting, and that was extremely difficult. And the fact that students persevered through that is pretty remarkable. We're in our, this will be our third year of graduating classes. There's 170 kids in the program. There's one story I like to tell. Isaac Cortez, who is in the second class, he's in communications at the Summit County Public Health Department. So the idea of these full circle moments where these students are able to go to college or get a secondary degree and then come back and support their community and their families who have made so many sacrifices is amazing. So we provide the structure for the program, and it is an expensive program, no doubt about it, because we're paying salaries for people to help the students, we're paying for scholarships, and we're paying for emergency funds. And so all of that is funding is required.
Okay, and that's what I was going to ask. So that's where the money raised goes to pay the program managers?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. So we have two staff people who are pretty Bright Futures specific, one who helps college students and one who helps the high school students and runs the program. And then there's also a big piece is the scholarship piece, of course, because there is funding out there, but there's never 100% funding. And then there's also undocumented students, and they're not eligible for a lot of the national and federal funding that's out there. And so that's a big piece, is the scholarship piece. And then, of course, there's emergency things that come up. And we especially found that during COVID. So that's where all the funding goes.
Yeah, I talked to a couple of the students. They both had gotten basically full ride scholarships to University of Utah based on their grades.
Yes.
So the money that they needed help with, though, were a place to, you know, to live.
Right. So most scholarships don't cover every single piece. They might not cover books, or they might not cover housing. There are more of those out there, and that is one thing that the high school staff does an amazing job helping those kids get those scholarships and making sure their grades are high enough. But what happens if you're living up here still at home and you're driving to school and you need new tires? That isn't covered by a scholarship. Or what happens if all the students are expected to work and help contribute. And so if you're also going to school full time and working almost full time, and somehow you might not be able to meet your rent payment, who steps in? You can't ask your parents to step in, you know, like my kids can. You ask the Ed Foundation.
Yeah. Any idea how much money's been raised over the past 10 years?
So I would say, I should know this off the top of my head, probably $2.5 million has been raised over the last 10 years. Our community is incredibly generous and supportive of this program.
Yeah, and I was going to mention, because I know that there are private donors that dedicate just to this. Jim Doyle, of course, I talked to, and I know first-gen college students is really important to him based on just what, you know, happened
with
his parents.
His other family foundation. Bob Richer was involved, Hank Lewis and his wife were some of the early donors, and we've gotten some really great people to step up. Out of this $2.5 million Jennifer's alluding to in the 170 students, we have probably already, out of Bright Futures, spent $578,000 already on scholarships for this group of kids. And there's going to be four times that needed down the road if we're going to continue to help. We feel at Bright Futures and certainly at the Ed Foundation, this is a moral imperative. We've made a commitment here, and we need to see it through.
Yeah. And you mentioned, 83% graduation rate? So
yes.
College, we know, isn't for everybody, but even
yep.
getting through a couple of years of college, at least kids can, explore something that they're good at.
Absolutely. So several students have their associate's degree. So SLCC, Salt Lake Community College, is an amazing partner and a great school that either feeds into the four-year colleges or gets kids great jobs. There are students that might want to go to trade school. So I know when the program started, it really was all about a four-year degree, but our world world has actually changed so much in the last 10 years. If you look at the CTE building over at the high school, for instance, where there's the professional kitchen, professional construction lab, professional health and sciences. So there are great paying jobs that perhaps might not be with a four-year degree. So we're really here to support the students' dreams and their path to what will support their families and make their family sacrifices worth it. And as Tommy alluded to, so there's at least 7 years of classes going on, 10th, 11th, 12th, and then 4 years of college. Now, I know I took 5 years to graduate, and that is completely common in the Bright Future space too. So there are students that are in their fifth or sixth year even. There's students that might take time off for a mission. You know, there's students that might take a gap year and really just need to work for a year to help build their reserves back up. So we're trying to support students no matter where they're at in their path toward that degree.
Tommy, do you have any success stories that you like to brag about?
Oh, listen, Mayor Nan, who was part of the original board along with Becca Gerber, she told the story about one of the students and who was an intern from Bright Futures at the city and now got put the first Latino student to get put on the board of the city planning boards. And there's just so many. A few of them spoke the other night. We have kids now that are finished college and are going to go back to graduate school. They're going to go to medical school, dental school, accounting school. And like you say, when you see such a growing minority population, you can just know that down the road, you're going to need doctors, you're going to need lawyers, you're going to need Indian chiefs. We're going to need people running all those things. And what better group than the Latino people who've really all they needed was this little boost. And now they're getting it, and it's coming back to contribute to the community.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about it?
So Bright Futures will be fundraising during Live PC, Give PC. And so I would encourage everyone, all of your listeners, when you're looking at all the amazing nonprofits to give to please go to the PCEF Bright Futures page and donate to support the students of families who make our town run.
Okay, guys, thanks so much.
Thank you, Leslie.
Tommy Tanzer and Jen Bellow, you're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, a California man has been charged for allegedly transporting 83 pounds of pot, psychedelics, and other drugs through Summit County. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on that drug bust.
50-year-old Dwayne Joseph Lee was traveling east on I-80 Sunday, just past U.S. Highway 40, when the Utah Highway Patrol measured him going 10 over the speed limit. Court papers filed Monday say a state trooper stopped Lee, allegedly smelled marijuana, then searched his vehicle. The trooper says that search revealed 83 pounds of marijuana, 6 large vacuum-sealed bags of psilocybin mushrooms, 4,000 MDMA or ecstasy pills, 200 THC cartridges, 3 dozen packages of edibles, plus multiple pre-rolled joints. Lee, who was identified by his California driver's license, allegedly told the trooper he did not have a medical marijuana card. It's unclear what his destination was. Third District Judge Richard Mrozek has ordered he be held in the county jail without bond. Two of Lee's charges are second-degree felonies. The other is a third degree. He faces up to 35 years in prison if convicted on all counts. An initial appearance date had not been scheduled as of Tuesday afternoon. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And Park City planners will be taking a deep dive into Deer Valley Resort's reimagined snow park base tonight. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on that.
The future of transportation in Snow Park will be the main topic of discussion at Wednesday's special meeting of the Park City Planning Commission. Deer Valley is proposing a complete redevelopment of the Snow Park base to create a new village with hotels, condos, and commercial space. To limit the traffic impacts of the development, Deer Valley agreed to reduce the amount of day skier parking by 20%. Today, there are 1,700 day skier parking spaces at Snow Park, but in the future, that will be cut down below 1,400. The resort plans to construct over 1,900 underground parking spaces at Snow Park, but over 600 spots will be limited to uses other than skiing. To make it all work, the Planning Commission wants Deer Valley to reduce the number of single-occupancy vehicles entering Snow Park. Park City estimates that nearly 60% of all vehicle trips to Lower Deer Valley are single-occupancy. Deer Valley will address those and other various details about the project at Wednesday's meeting, including the potential for paid parking or reservation system. Commissioners are also looking for more information about the proposed installation of a traffic signal at the Deer Valley Drive Y intersection by the Deer Valley Cafe. According to a traffic study conducted by a consultant hired by Deer Valley, the new snow park is expected to generate over 3,000 new weekly trips to the area. Wednesday's meeting is scheduled to begin at 5:30 p.m. at City Hall. The agenda and a link to attend virtually can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And in between slices of free pie, a small crowd of locals took turns on the open mic to share their favorite lines from books and poems at the Park City Library on Saturday. KPCW's Christine Muller says the readings were part of the first Wasatch Back Book Festival.
Bill Humbert, a former Park City Library board member, read lines from The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, lines that awakened his sense of adventure, leading him into danger and saving his life. The words that inspired Humbert come from a passage that describes Tom, Huckleberry Finn, and their friend Joe leaving to be pirates on an island for a weekend. They didn't tell anyone about the excursion, and their parents thought the boys drowned in the river.
Tom said, "Boys, I know who's drowned. It's us." They felt like heroes in an instant. Here is a gorgeous triumph. They were missed. They were mourned. Hearts were breaking on their account.
Following their lead, in May 1969, Humbert and some friends set out to hitchhike 15,000 miles from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. By early August, the adventurers were in Los Angeles, driving toward cult leader Charles Manson's ranch just days after his clan committed a series of murders.
We got a ride with Manson's girls in Santa Monica, and they tried to recruit us to the Spahn Ranch. And the driver said, in a half a mile, we're going to turn up the canyon road to the ranch. Do you want to come with us, or are you going to go to San Francisco? And I told her, we set a goal to hitchhike from L.A. to San Francisco in 24 hours because we want to stand on the corner of Hayton Ashbury. And she said, that's such a cool scene. You need to do it.
That's when Humbert and his friends went their own way. Humbert shared his page-turning story to some laughs and gasps at the Favorite Lines and Pies Festival event, which is part of Utah's wider celebration of National Book Month. Both community members and authors came together for Lines and Pies, with some reading their own work and others sharing broader messages. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And this final note, to keep pumpkins out of the landfill, local organizations are joining forces to offer an alternative to tossing your jack-o'-lantern into the trash once trick-or-treating ends. The Park City Community Foundation, along with the Park City School District, Spoil to Soil, and Momentum Recycling will have 15 pumpkin composting locations around Park City in the Snyderville Basin. Dates vary by location, but composting will begin available starting today and continue through the end of November. Last year, the program successfully delivered more than 30,000 pounds of pumpkins from entering the landfill. The Community Foundation says that saved the county more than $4,400 in landfill space costs and prevented more than 4,000 pounds of methane emissions from being released into the atmosphere. A list of all of the composting locations and dates and to register for the Pumpkin Smash is available at kpcw.org. That smash is happening at the Mark Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 FM in Wasatch County.